and its final destination. The emerging blood-slicked arrow moved more slowly than it had covered the yards between Nona and the archer. But it was not slow, and lubricated with her blood, her grip would not reduce its speed below a lethal level before the arrow left her hands. Nona pulled down, hoping she could be gentle enough to draw the arrowhead down rather than snap off the rear portion. She watched the arrow's flights escape her hands. In the same instant, the steel point, deflected slightly downward, touched her beneath the collarbone. By the time her hands caught up with the end of the arrowhead was buried 3 inches deep in her shoulder, slowed by the thickness of her flesh, and turned further from its path by the rotation of her body as she fell backward. She grasped the wood again, willing some sharpness into her touch, hoping it would help to grip rather than reduce the shaft to sections. Still no hint of the pain had reached her. She knew by the length of arrow that had vanished into her that the arrowhead must have emerged high on her back, but she felt nothing. The sharpness in her fingers shaved pieces from the arrow like a carpenter's plane on timber. The rear of it fell into tumbling inch-long sections. They bounced off her, peppering the area around the bloody hole beneath her collarbone as she fell. She knew her head would hit the sand hard, but the impact never came. She fell, and there was no bottom to it, just whiteness, and then no color at all. Chapter 18. Nona spat sand from her mouth, finding more between her teeth and behind her lips than she could get rid of. Something cold and wet covered her face. She tried to push it away. The pain arrived in that instant, all at once, something too huge for her body, trying to explode out from beneath muscle and skin. She screamed, or tried to. It came out more as a whimper. The wet thing moved, and through eyes screwed tight in agony, she saw the blur of someone leaning over her, cloth in hand.
"Stay still." Sister Rose set a hand to Nona's chest.
"Hessa."
Nona tried to roll, but the white fire in her shoulder stopped her more effectively than the nun.
"Hessa's fine."
A smile.
"The arrow hit the ground a foot before her."
Sister Rose looked to the side.
"We need to move her,"
called to someone else. Other voices reached into Nona's awareness. She focused on the roof high above her, the sand beneath her heels. She was still in Blade Hall. People were talking to her right. A roll of her head brought them into view. Abbess Glass stood there, free of the yoke, head high. Sister Apple at her shoulder. The Archons and the High Priest faced her, all of them on the practice sand now. Looking the other way, she saw a host of nuns and novices, church guards escorting them from the hall, and everyone leaving as slowly as possible so as not to miss anything. Sisters Flint, Kettle, and Mop were approaching, presumably to carry Nona to the sanatorium, though any one of them could lift her.
"Irregular! In this day and age, to be thwarting the due process of the Emperor's law with archaic texts and talk of prophecy. You would do well to give the child over to the civil judges, Abbess, however thick the Hunska runs in her veins. It's very disappointing. This matter could make all kinds of trouble for us, not the least of it in the Emperor's own court."
"What disappoints me, Jacob, is that you appear to have been purchased wholesale, along with your staff and office, for something as worthless as money."
Abbess Glass raised her voice, not shouting, but lending it the power to reach the rafters.
"The Church of the Ancestor is not for sale. You bring the Archons here, racing from the four corners of Empire, and then slap them in the face with a veto when their opinion is not the one Thurin Taxis purchased? I say there should be a vote of no confidence. Here and now."
The High Priest snarled, the same look he wore when he raised his staff to strike a blow across Forefoot's back.
It's not your place to call any such.
I call for a vote.
Archon Kraton rubbed at his scars, scowling.
Can't say I'm impressed, High Priest. 3 days on horseback to reach Verity. From what the bird brought wrapped around its leg, I thought to find the walls fallen, or the Emperor proved a bastard. The Scythrol heresy afoot in the streets. Instead, a child has humbled a bully. And if we're to believe she's the Argatha's shield, then you put a hole in her just because you wouldn't trust the Abbess's word. I vote for vacation of office.
Archon Philo, looming over his fellow clerics lean and languorous, in sharp contrast to Kraton's compact strength and restless energy.
Anasta?
The eldest of them rolled the ball of her earring through long fingers, then lowered the hand to fold into her other.
You have no idea how uncomfortable it is to spend 5 nights on the Blue Wine when it's in full spate. A riverboat's no way to travel at the best of times. I get seasick looking at a cup of water. But, she raised her hand, it would not have concerned me had the summons been for a matter of import. It might even have been forgivable as a lone lapse of judgment. If our decision had been respected. But to bring us scurrying to Verity like lapdogs, just to underwrite your own sentence on poor glass here, I vote for vacation of office.
She turned to her left.
Archon Nevis.
The fat Archon ran both hands over the grey curls of his hair, still thick at the sides, and at the top, as bald and shiny as Anasta's head was all over.
Vacation.
Which leaves me,
Kraton said, stepping sharply across to the High Priest until they stood face to face, eyes on a level.
And as the vote would have to be unanimous to remove you, I find myself mattering.
Kraton, we should discuss this in private. There are issues that...
I've never had a particularly good opinion of your term in office, Jacob. The staff does things to a man, most of them bad. Doesn't do to have too many people around you whose position depends on their being agreeable. Even so, I would have voted to keep you, but for one thing. A High Priest can be stupid. He can be greedy. He can be wrong. But what he can't be is purchased. I voted to put you in the office, and I'll stand by that. I didn't vote to put a Taxus in the robe and hat, though. You'll have to go. I'm sorry. Vacation of office.
Somebody had their hands on Nona, crouched over her, ready to lift, but nobody was going anywhere until this was done. The silence behind her let Nona know that the nuns had given up any pretense of leaving.
This is outrageous!
The High Priest backed away from the Archons and Abbess, limping on the leg the roof tiles had injured, his staff held defensively before him.
No High Priest has ever...
High Priest Albur was removed by his Archons 43 years ago, during the last narrowing, Abbess Glass offered.
And High Priestess Sartre, a century before that,
for indelicate relations, Archon Anasta added, nodding.
I won't. This is a conspiracy.
High Priest Jacob purpled. He stared in Nona's direction.
A trick, guards! Take these Archons into custody! Yoke them!
A pair of church guards moved to flank the High Priest. The rest were at the fore of the hall to usher out the now unwelcome audience. The first of those guards to move took one step before Sister Talus' foot found the back of his knee, and he collapsed to the floor with a clatter. Another guard reached for her, but Tallow caught the woman's wrist, and with a twist had her tumbling to the sand. The guard behind reached for his sword.
"My title is Mistress Blade, young man. I have been a Red Sister since before you were born. Do not try me."
The guard, who didn't look particularly young to Nona, stopped with just an inch of steel gleaming above his scabbard, and looked across to the far end of the hall. The two church guards beside High Priest Jacob had their hands on their sword hilts, but showed no enthusiasm for arresting the Archons. Archon Kraton raised his voice before the High Priest could master his outrage.
"Captain Rogan, your loyalty to the High Priest is not in question, but this man is no longer the High Priest. You will have to put your faith in the judgment of four Archons and a convent full of nuns when it comes to the legalities of the matter. But I can assure you that our proceedings have been every bit as correct here as they were in the court in which we served immediately prior to these events. Please tell your men to stand at ease."
The silent moment that followed seemed as long as any that Nona had clung to in the ordeal.
"At ease, guards."
"This is treachery, blasphemy. The Emperor will hear of it and set your heads on stakes."
Jacob seemed half-crazed, clutching his staff as if it were his former rank and not some piece of gilded wood.
"The Emperor will hear."
A whisper now.
"And you are welcome to tell him, Jacob,"
Archon Nevis said, his face near as solemn as Archon Philo's.
"You are free to go. In time, I hope you will agree to serve in one of my dioceses. Priest Martu of Gelim passed to the ancestor last month, and his flock would benefit from the wisdom of a church elder."
"Gelim? Are you mad? It's a wild ice swamp on the margins."
The former High Priest started towards the main door, half stamping, half limping.
"I'm going to the palace. Anyone who tries to stop me will hang."
The Archons watched him go.
"We should recover the staff," Archon Philo said.
"Let him keep it,"
Abbess Glass smiled.
"It's just a stick.
Besides, he'll need it on the way down. The footing can be treacherous."
"We find ourselves in need of a new High Priest."
Archon Philo flexed his long hands and interlaced his fingers before him.
"Well, we're all here," Kraton said. "We could retire to a room and talk in circles for hours, or just get done with it and go home. Damned if I want to spend any longer than I have to on this windswept lump of rock. No offence, Glass."
"None taken."
Archon and Asta swept the crowd with a dark gaze.
"We could ask for no better witnesses."
"I vote Anasta,"
Archon Philo said.
"I vote Nevis."
Archon Anasta inclined her head.
"He showed the greatest courage today and will make fewest ripples with the Emperor."
Archon Nevis looked surprised.
"I vote Nevis too."
He hugged his belly, smile spreading.
"I suppose,"
Kraton waved a hand as if the matter were trifling.
"Nevis, then."
The three of them turned to look up at Archon Philo.
"Really, Anasta?"
She nodded.
"At my age, what I want is a comfortable chair, not too far from the privy, not too close. And chamomile tea. Lots of it."
"Nevis, then," That's done, then.
Archon Kraton dusted off his hands.
Congratulations, High Priest Nevis. You can pay for your own staff. Now, if you don't mind, I have a church to consecrate, an outbreak of shellpox to deal with, and a prize mare that may already have given birth. Shall we go?
You forget, Kraton. Anasta raised a hand. We're short of one Archon. I suggest the new High Priest pick Abbess Glass.
Nevis frowned and bowed his head, chins doubling, then tripling.
That would be irregular, but...
At the far end of the hall, the main door slammed shut behind the former incumbent.
Thank you, Abbess Glass took a step towards High Priest Nevis. But no, my place is here. I have my sisters to serve, novices to raise to nuns, and besides, politicking has never been my forte.
The High Priest and all three Archons spluttered with laughter at that, Nevis and Anasta laughing longest.
Abbess Glass,
Nevis wiped at his eyes.
Sometimes I think that if you ever gave up the great game, the ice would close on us.
He looked at the sisters to either side of her.
Get this woman to the sanatorium and the child. She probably bleeds faster than anyone should, too.
He clapped his hands and Nona found herself lifted easily in Sister Kettle's arms. The pain bit once more, hard, making her cry out, and she buried her face against Kettle's shoulder as the nun carried her from the hall. Chapter 19 Sister Rose had given Nona a bitter drink that looked like ditch water. Sleep had taken her almost immediately. Now she cracked open a bleary eye and tried to focus. She felt much like she imagined the sheets in the laundry must after being trampled in the tubs.
Abbess?
Nona finally made sense of the blurred shape beside her. Her voice escaped in a cracked whisper that seemed to go unnoticed. She brought up a hand to examine the hole beneath her collarbone, only to discover both it and her other hand were bound in strips of linen, stained across the palms with some kind of orange paste. She rolled with a groan and felt an echo of her earlier pain. Linen sheets limited her movement, and she discovered herself naked beneath them, save for the broad strips of gauze wrapped around the injured shoulder, across her chest, and beneath the right arm.
Abbess?
The word came louder this time. Abbess Glass leaned over from her bed and held a cup of water for Nona to sip from. She looked old, papery wrinkles around her eyes.
More.
Drink it all if you can. Nona found she could. Now, sleep. And Nona found she could do that, too. Within the sanatorium, Sister Rose's opinion held ultimate authority. It didn't matter who had just been offered an Archon's chair, or who had just passed the ordeal of the shield. The small ward boasted 5 beds, all in a line, opposite a large window overlooking the private herb garden. Abbess Glass lay in the bed furthest from the door, Nona in the one next to her. That first day, Sister Rose allowed no visitors. By evening, Nona lay propped up on pillows watching the sun set behind the rooftop across the garden. Abbess Glass sat reading from one of several scrolls piled on the table beside her. She had bandages on both wrists, and her right hand was still heavily wrapped. Awkward with her left, she cursed like a woodsman the third time the scroll escaped her and rolled itself up, only to remember Nona's presence and break off into a fake cough.
"Your name has been spoken before the Emperor in his throne room, Nona. Did you know that?"
The abbess looked across from her work.
"My name?"
Nona blinked. She couldn't imagine even her name entering the palace.
"A high priest has fallen. It's no small matter. The church is one of the pillars upon which the Emperor's power rests.
He has considerable interest in it being solid from the foundation to the highest point. Thurantaxis was summoned to court. He has pledged to put aside his grievance against you, and by extension, the convent that shelters you. The matter is closed. And you believe him? Nona saw Raymel Taxis's face. The same arrogance had been mirrored on his brother's. They would not forgive or forget. Thurantaxis is a cold and ruthless man. He would murder 1,000 small girls if they stood in the way of his ambition. But he is not a mad dog. Oaths are not lightly given to the Emperor. He will move on. Our Lord Taxis has bigger fish to fry than you, novice, and this matter has already set him back. Don't forget him, though, for he will surely not forget you. Some people have a slow anger in them that builds up a piece at a time, so you won't see it coming. Such anger has a momentum to it, so it'll come to the boil sometimes, even when the thing provoking it has stopped. Thurantaxis is not alone in that. Watch for such people, Nona. But yes, I believe him. For now. Nona let the tension run from her, giving herself to the pillow's embrace. Outside, the rain fell at a steep, wind-borne slant. Did that old nun really talk about me 100 years ago? No. The abbess didn't look up, only tilted her scroll more towards the candles she had just lit. But Nona hadn't wanted it to be true, but the sudden dismissal left her feeling slightly put out. But they said Sister Argatha was a famous holy witch. She made a prophecy. There's no such thing as prophecy, Nona. Or rather there is, but it's madmen that tell them, or people who were once listened to for their wisdom and have found themselves growing old and unwise, yet still wanting to be heard. There's no magic in it. Magic doesn't work that way. Sister Argatha was feeble-minded when she said it? Nona watched the red glow fade above the rooftop. I didn't want to be the shield in any case. I wanted to be the sword. The abbess laid down her scroll with a sigh, straightening it out. It promptly sprang back into a tight coil the moment she lifted her hand. You deserve the truth, Nona, and I don't want to stain Sister Argatha's good name in any case, but you must promise to keep what I tell you to yourself. Can you do that? Yes. Nona was good at keeping secrets. No telling that Clara you're so tight with. No, Abbess. Abbess Glass folded her hands in her lap, then winced, and unfolded them. Sister Rose had given her 3 doses of sorin bark for the pain, but Nona saw that she still suffered, moving with the brittle delicacy of those who carry the worst kinds of hurt. Sister Argatha did a great many things, most good, some bad, and twice to my knowledge they were plain stupid. What she did not do is make prophecies. The Argatha prophecy was the work of 2 archons about 35 years ago, when Emperor Crucicle's grandfather, Edesat, was on the throne. They were troubled times. Edesat was in his dotage, his eldest son in exile. War threatened with the Durnishmen. Ice winds ruined several harvests. The prophecy gave us focus. It reminded us of the salvation the ancestor promised us. It reminded us that the Ark could be opened, would be opened, and that we owned it together. What's inside? Nona asked. Nobody knows, the abbess said. But given that the Emperor's authority rests on the fact that he controls the Ark, it would be nice if he could open it, no? But someone must know, Nona frowned. Maybe someone does. The trouble is that so many people claim to know, and their claims are so varied, that it's hard to know which, if any, are correct. A lot of people believe that it can control the moon. The moon, but... The point is that the prophecy told us that the key lay among us, among our children or the children yet to be. I believed it heart and soul. I was a young woman then, and zealous. She managed to smile, though pain still haunted her eyes. In any event, it served its purpose. I didn't learn the truth until I became abbess here, and had access to the sectioned histories. It doesn't matter much now, but this is not a tale that should spread. I'm trusting you, Nona, and that's a burden rather than a gift. Do you understand that?
I understand. At least she half understood. But didn't the High Priest know? The Archons, too?
Jacob was never a great one for reading or listening. The Abbess's smile was fuller this time. The Archons? I'm sure Anasta knew. Philo, too. Probably. Craton? I don't know. He often surprises me. Nevis? Perhaps not. Or perhaps, like Sister Weald, they know, but choose to believe anyway. Nona frowned.
So why did you save me?
You heard what I told the Archons? It was enough for them to find me innocent.
But you said you had a...
I lied, Nona. I do that sometimes, even when someone isn't threatening to fork my tongue and whip me from the convent. Nona remembered what the abbess had said when they were hurrying from the prison. Words are steps along a path. The important thing is to get where you're going. And where had the abbess got?
You didn't like the High Priest?
No.
He was a thorn in your side?
More like a knife in my kidney.
And you don't like Thurin Taxis?
No.
And now Thurin doesn't have the High Priest for a friend?
He doesn't have the High Priest in his pocket, no. For all his faults, Nevis will not sell himself so cheaply as Jacob did.
Why are you telling me these things?
Nona frowned, trying to see if the abbess was mocking her. You asked.
But you shouldn't talk about Archons like that. Not to a novice. Not to me. I'm so new.
Your shoes may still be shiny, Nona, but your habit has several holes in it. The abbess regarded her, unsmiling. You bled for me. I owe you some answers. Or perhaps I want to see how closely you keep secrets.
If the High Priest were such a bad one, why didn't the Archons vote him out before?
It had seemed a simple enough matter. The Archons each have their own see to govern, and their cathedrals are very far from verity. You have to move mountains to get two Archons in the same place, let alone four. It's an assembly I could never have called.
But the High Priest didn't even need them to throw you out?
He needed them to make it look like something other than a grudge. We have a history, Jacob and I. Just declaring me guilty would make him look weak. A man who spends as long as the High Priest does in the Emperor's court can't afford to look weak. There are too many sharks in those waters. He thought he had more of a hold on the Archons than he did. More sway. If just one of them had agreed with him, there would not have been an issue. So Thurin Taxis floated all four Archons to my doorstep on a river of gold, just to get at you, dear.
And you knew he would.
Nona started to see the shape of something, the outline of a plan. I thought it likely, the abbess nodded.
But you burned yourself, even though you knew it wouldn't help. You knew it wouldn't change the High Priest's mind.
Yes.
Because you knew it would make me say I would take the ordeal. But I said I would at the start.
If I had accepted your offer at that point, the Archons would never have voted the staff from Jacob's hand. They had to see me suffer. They had to see him make me suffer. Getting four Archons in one place is a feat, but is nothing compared to the task of getting them to agree on something of import.
So, all this, from that first day, was to bring down the High Priest and hurt Thurin Taxis?
The abbess just watched her.
How could you know I would pass the ordeal?
Nona shifted her shoulder and winced. Hessa almost hadn't survived, and even a scratch on her would have seen Nona drowned. Sister Tala watched you that first day at Blade. A small girl who could wreak such harm on Raymel Taxus that it takes 4 Academy men to hold him on the edge of life, a Jared Pitt fighter. I thought that such a child would be fast. Sister Tala watched you on the sand and told me that she herself was not so swift in her prime. Nona lay silent then, the pain of her wound pulsing, her hands and wrists burning with a deep fire. Abbess Glass was neither fast nor strong. She had no obvious wealth. Her office held no great sway, and yet, with her truth and with her lies, she had turned one wheel against another, and in due course mountains had moved, the mighty had fallen, and the world sang the song she chose for it. Nona didn't know how she felt about that. She knew that she had tried to lay some portion of her guilt over Sida's death on the Abbess's steps, and that in truth the guilt was hers, and hers alone. She should never have stopped fighting, never allowed them to be taken to face justice. Nona knew that she didn't understand people, not how they worked in their webs of fragile, flexible friendships and shifting loyalties, not how the games of smiles and hugs, scowls and turned backs were played at court or over a convent breakfast table, and not the workings of their hidden hearts. She knew she didn't understand these things, but with Abbess Glass she understood still less. They had wanted to throw Nona chained into the black and unreflecting waters of the sinkhole, where novices swam and bones crowded in the silt deep below the kicking of their legs. Abbess Glass and that sinkhole perhaps had more in common than their name. Glass and her church. Nona had no loyalty to either now. And perhaps that was just another of the Abbess's wheels turning. But the time to run had passed her by. She had called Clara and Hessa friends, and that bond ran deeper than blood. It was the foundation of a world that she could understand, a faith that mattered. Chapter 20. Abbess Glass returned to her house and to her duties after that first night. Nona lay abed 3 more days, with Sister Rose in close attendance. Clara and Ruli came to see her on the first morning, released from academia for the visit. Ruli, shy at first, hiding behind her hair, Clara all smiles and hugs from the moment she burst through the door. They sat on her bed and chatted about everything except what had happened. Clara told them of a ball her father had taken her to back before his fall from grace.
And then Valera came in. She's the younger sister, but that never stopped her complaining that her brother sits on the throne while she slums it in her palace on the coast. Anyway, she had Lord Jotsis on her arm, the young one, and the Jersis heir on the other side, and her dress. She looked like she had been poured into it. My father said she spilled some.
Hessa came that evening on her own, stumping in on her crutch.
"I see Sister Rose gave you my bed."
She lowered herself carefully to sit on the end. They spoke of the ordeal.
"I didn't see anything," Hessa said. "Just the guards and Sister Wheel getting ready to throw, and in the same moment something hitting the wall beside me. I jumped so hard I nearly fell over. I did fall over when you did. I had to wave my arms and tell them I hadn't been hit."
Jula came the next day with Clara.
"We can only come in twos. Sister Rose says we'll tire you out. Sister Kettle wanted to send you your slate and some lettering, but Rosie wouldn't let her."
Clara sat down breathlessly.
"Imagine that, wounded and having to do letters."
Jula came to Nona more cautiously, hugging her as if she might break, her short hair bristly against Nona's cheek. As they parted, her lower lip trembled.
thank the ancestor you're all right. I thought...
Her voice broke, and Nona was amazed to see that she was crying. It wasn't until the morning of the third day that Nona told Sister Rose her fear. The hole that the arrow put in her, and the damage to hands and wrists she knew would heal. But her body had let her down, had failed her when she most needed it.
"The abbess thinks I'm fast,"
Nona said it between gulps of a sour brew that Sister Rose kept tipping to her lips, though she could hold it by herself.
"But I'm not. I tried to be fast with the arrow. I thought I could, but I just couldn't. I got so tired."
"Tired?" Sister Rose laughed, her face mounding and crinkling. "That's the Hunska burn. Everyone gets it. Leastways all of you with lightning in your veins. I can't move that quickly, but I can lumber on for hours." Sister Rose took the cup away and squinted into it, checking that Nona had had the nasty gritty bits at the bottom. "You're using up your resources when you do those things." She pinched Nona's arm. "And you're all bones anyhow. What have you got to burn? I'm amazed you managed what you did. Most Hunskas are ready to fall over after just a few seconds of fighting at speed. Drinking sugar water after helps, but there's only so much your body can give. Take too much and something will break. With Hunska, it's normally the heart. Not that you last long one way or the other."
"We don't?"
Nona sat up, her shoulder an ache now rather than a pain. "Mistress Academia has..." "Of course not." The humour left her. "I forgot how little time you've been with us, Nona." Sister Rose set the cup aside and drew her chair as close to the bed as her legs would allow. "The four tribes that came to Abeth found it a harsh world, even before the ice. It was mixing their blood that bred a few people who could live here. The Hunska and the Gerent live short lives, one too fast for their hearts in this land, the other too large. Sister Tallow is the oldest Hunska I've known, and she isn't as old as she looks, not by a long margin. The Quantal and Marjal draw on the power of place, tapping into the magics that lie beneath and above and through all the things of this world. But this is not the land that bred them, and its magics are sharp, quick to burn the unwary or warp them." A knock at the door cut Nona off. Sister Rose patted her hands. "Those that burn short burn bright. The shortest lives can cast the longest shadows." Nona thought of Sida cold in the ground, and the shadows she cast. The knocking came again. "Come!" Sister Rose struggled to her feet. The door to the foyer opened, and Arabella Jotzes stuck her head around, her scalp now covered with short blonde hair, making something boyish of her.
"Sister Pan has asked to see Nona and me."
"Well, you can tell Sister Pan that Nona isn't leaving this..."
"It's for the naming."
"Oh." Sister Rose looked at Nona, back at Arabella, back at Nona.
"How do you feel, Nona? Could you manage a walk to the Path Tower, do you think? I could get some sisters to carry you."
"No, I can walk."
Nona swung her legs off the bed and got up before Sister Rose could insist she be lifted like a baby. Her shoulder hurt worse than she had thought it would, but she gritted her teeth against it and walked to the door with more care. Outside, the cold made her gasp. An ice wind had come, blowing off the southern sheet, and 3 days in the sanatorium's warmth had left her open to it.
"Filthy weather."
Arabella hugged her habit around her, but didn't hurry. Nona could see the restraint in her steps and tried to walk more quickly, her shoulder flooding with hot, wet pain at each jolt.
"What's the naming?"
Nona thought those might be the first 3 words she had spoken to Arabella. It seemed odd to be walking with her, as if everything were normal. As if Arabella had never tried to stab her in her bed, as if they hadn't been enemies from the first moment. But if that fake prophecy got its teeth into them, Arabella Jotzes might be forced to play the role of Chosen One, and Nona, her reluctant shield.
"The naming?"
Do you think Sister Kettle was called Kettle by her mother?
Arabella watched her with a sideways look and an amused smile.
But the older novices, they still have their names. Celeri is in holy class, and she's still Celeri.
Nona scowled, wondering whether Celeri was the name of a thing like glass or apple, but just one that peasants didn't know.
Yes, but they all have their holy names. They just have to keep them secret until they take their orders and become nuns, if they get that far. Every novice gets to choose their name in front of Mistress Parth when she calls them. She calls most of them during their first year.
Nona relaxed. She hadn't wanted to give up her name.
We'll still be Arabella and Nona, then. Ara.
What?
Ara. Everyone calls me Ara. You should, too.
Path Tower loomed above them, dark against the morning, the four open approaches framed in stone.
I take the east door,
Ara said.
Why? That's where the path leads me.
Ara paused, tilting her head to study the smaller girl.
Try it. Close your eyes and see,
she laughed.
That's what Sister Pan says.
Nona closed her eyes. She saw only what she always saw, orange and grey, after images pulsing and fading, the last traces shaped into ideas and suggestions, the edges of dreams.
Do you see it?
Ara, almost at her ear.
No. Look harder.
A hand touched Nona's shoulder, and in that moment what she saw became an edged brilliance, a hot darkness, one cutting through the other like a fracture, though she couldn't say which cut the other, and both driven through her head, hammer-hard, splintering against the back of her skull.
Ona!
Nona opened her eyes, slitted against the brightness of a grey sky.
Nona!
A dark shape looming over her.
Where?
Nona could feel hands on her arm, lifting her up.
I'm really sorry.
Ara sounded it too, though she sounded like a really sorry princess.
I forgot about your shoulder.
Nona got to her feet, snarling in pain, ready to fight. The girl had pulled her up by her bad arm, and her wound felt as though the arrow were back in it and red hot.
You didn't!
Nona bit off the words. She couldn't see any mockery in Ara's eyes, no hint of a smile, just concern. Ara hadn't put her hand on the wounded shoulder. She couldn't see the bandaging under Nona's habit. She had just assumed she had because Nona collapsed, and so she had used the other arm to help her up, the wounded arm. Nona brushed herself off.
I'll use the door you do.
Together they covered the remaining distance and went through the east door into the portrait room at the base of Path Tower. The painting directly facing the east door was of a woman's face. Half black, half white, the black half with a white eye, the white half with a black one. A strip of grey ran between the two halves, but coming nearer, Nona saw it was just that the boundary between the halves wasn't a straight line as she had first seen it, but infinitely convoluted, black fingering into white, white into black.
She's beautiful, isn't she?
Ara came to stand beside Nona.
It's Sister Cloud. She was a two-blood. Full-blood Hanska and full-blood Marjol.
That sounds pretty full, Nona smiled.
It just means she had the full talents of both tribes.
Ara shrugged.
Sister Pan says there's one born every generation or so.
And this generation has you. Nona looked at Ara, harder than she had before. How deep did that confidence go? Was she frightened somewhere in there, beneath the face a noble's life had taught her to wear?
We should go up.
Ara let Nona set the pace on the steps, following behind. As Nona made her slow turns around the rising spiral, She tried to think back to the grievances she had harbored against the girl behind her. Ara's crimes appeared to be confined to being beautiful, being born rich, and being the chosen one. Everything else, Nona realized, was something given to her by Clara, or something assumed. She had assumed that the remainder of half-heard jokes were at her expense, that the laughter that faded as she entered a room had been at her.
"Ready?"
Ara asked, her smile nervous. Nona found that she had come to a halt just below the classroom. She also found in that moment a sudden realization. Arabella Jotsis was very easy to like.
"Ready,"
Nona said, and they went up together. Sister Pan was waiting for them, sitting without formality in a student's chair, and gestured for them to pull up chairs of their own. She looked impossibly old, like the corpses men find in the ice tunnels, blackened skin on bones, folded in on themselves like flowers before an ice wind.
"It's blowing out there."
When Sister Pan smiled, even that had something of a skull about it.
"The corridor will narrow tonight."
"And the moon will clear the path,"
Ara said, giving the proper reply.
"And the moon will clear the path."
Sister Pan nodded.
"Did you know that the moon is falling?"
Nona glanced at Ara.
"No."
Again the skull grin.
"Not to worry. It's been falling all your life. And mine."
Sister Pan raised her hand, leathery but darker than any leather, cupped just a little as if shining moonlight down upon the world.
"It's been falling ever since they put it up there. The light presses against it. Sun's wind, too. And as it drifts close, it starts to scrape the very edges of our air, touching the highest of Abbott's winds. Then it will be swift."
Sister Pan brought her hand down onto her knee.
"Can we do anything?"
Ara asked, staring at the hand on Sister Pan's knee.
"No, at least nothing good."
The old nun shrugged.
"So, I called you to this place to hear what you're called."
"I've chosen,"
Ara said. She looked at Nona.
"Shouldn't we do this in private?"
Sister Pan turned her head one way, then the other.
"Nobody here but us."
"But," Ara frowned, "but we're not supposed to tell anyone our names. It's a secret until we take our orders."
"The Chosen One and the Shield don't have secrets from each other."
Nona kept her mouth closed. She didn't care who knew her name, though she wouldn't tell it. The abbess had wanted to know if she could keep a secret, and she could.
"I'm not the Chosen One,"
Ara said.
"I would know if I was, and besides, I can't do anything a Marjal can."
"Doesn't matter one way or the other,"
Sister Pan said.
"The prophecy is what's put you in danger. What's keeping you safe for now is this convent. Not the walls, not the sisters, red or grey or otherwise. It's that woman in the big house. Glass has a long reach, and a subtle one. Time was when I could have put a big enough hole in this rock we live on to swallow this tower whole. And even then I wasn't half as deadly as that woman. Not half."
She tilted her head, as if listening to distant music.
"The prophecy put you in danger because people half believe it. Make them believe it wholly, and it will start to look after you. Both of you."
"And we needed to look after us, because the abbess might change her mind?"
Nona asked.
"Because the wind will always blow, and the moon will keep on falling."
Sister Pan dusted her palm against her thigh and looked to them, expectant.
"Now, what are you to be called as sisters? Nona?"
Nona hadn't thought about it, not in her days at the convent surrounded by kettles, apples, glasses and wheels, not on the walk to the tower or the climb up the stairs. Pan smiled.
"Often sisters choose a name that makes them think of home, or something safe, something they cherish.
Nona tried to think of the village, of her house, her mother cutting the reeds, weaving one into the next. She thought of the Relum Forest, of the savagery and the death. She thought of her mother's face when they brought her child back from the wild, clothed in other people's blood.
"Choose carefully, Nona. Let the path lead you to a name."
Nona opened her mouth. "Cage," she said. "Let them call me Cage." Sister Pan pursed the wrinkled gristle of her lips.
"Cage."
She turned to Arabella Jotsis, who watched them both with a serenity Nona envied.
"And you, dear?"
"Thorn," Ara said. "I will be Sister Thorn."
Grey Class. It is important when killing a nun to ensure that you bring an army of sufficient skill. For Sister Thorn of the Sweet Mercy Convent, Lanotaxis brought Pilathi mercenaries, warriors drawn from the ice margins east of the Grey, from a tribe considered savage by their savage neighbors, brawlers, murderers, hard men and hard women who kill for coin, heretics who set the worship of past warlords,
not yet 3 centuries beneath the ground, above the veneration of the ancestor on whose shoulders all humanity stands,
and who make each man brother to the next. The throwing star, or cross knife as the Nói Gúin have it, is typically a weapon of distraction, to put off balance, to cause minor injury. But in the hands of a red sister, such projectiles become deadly. The bandolier above Sister Thorn's blackskin held 2 dozen stars, pointed for penetration rather than bladed for blood, each set about a central ring weighted with lead. They spat from her fingers as she ran between the pillars, the Pilathi shocked by the sudden swiftness of her, eye, throat, forehead, punching in through soft flesh and hard bone, eye, throat, a mouth open to roar for battle, swallowing the star's swift rotation amid broken teeth, forehead, throat, here a gerund, huge in his armor, pot-helm visored, a heavy gorget about his neck. The star arced as it flew, taking him in the wrist just beneath his gauntlet, tearing tendon and artery, leaving his great sword slipping from numb fingers. There is in the act of destruction a beauty which we try to deny, and a joy which we cannot. Children build to knock down, and though we may grow around it, that need runs in us deeper than our blood. Violence is the language of destruction. Flesh so often the subject, fragile, easy to break beyond repair, precious. What else would we burn to make the world take note? Your death has not been waiting for your arrival at the appointed hour. It has, for all the years of your life, been racing towards you with the fierce velocity of time's arrow. It cannot be evaded. It cannot be bargained with, deflected, or placated. All that is given to you is the choice. Meet it with open eyes and peace in your heart. Go gentle to your reward. Or burn bright, take up arms, and fight the bitch. There is in every delicate thing, no matter how precious nor how beautiful, a challenge. Break me. No bride of the ancestor can see life as anything but the fragile, wondrous gift that it is. From the Alpha to the Omega, we are all brothers, sisters, children, born of unity, bound for unity. And yet, those who take the red are trained to listen. Break me. Thorn carried in each limb every hour of her training, every day and year bound into the muscle of her arms, written along the length of her legs, beaten into the hardness of stomach and thigh. She knew 5 dozen ways to kill. She knew them with a lover's intimacy. And in the execution, perhaps lust also played its role. For what is lust but a hunger? And hunger must be fed. Any weapon begs use. The blade itself incites to violence. And those who mistake the Red Children of Sweet Mercy for anything other than a weapon are fools of their own breed. Flicked wrists, arms cracked like whips, and throwing stars take flight, possessed of their own fierce rotation, bound on twisted parabolas. No mother gave her child so much direction, or set them spinning along their course through the world with such care, governed only by the forces that steer the true stars through dark heavens. Thorn's bright offspring wing their way, deterministic, to known targets, trusted and independent, requiring no more of her attention. Spears are thrown in surprise, arrows released in confusion. She is among them and gone, a fleeting target in black and tattered red. Spears fly high, hit pillars, find the flesh of allies rather than foe. One Pilarthi, ice-blooded, hawk-eyed, looses at the flickering of her enemy, leading her mark. The arrow glances from Thorn's shoulder as she turns, the black skin stiffening to resist the missile's speed. The temporary rigidity of her armor hampers Thorn's reply. Her star tears skin at the corner of the archer's eye, rips her ear, and hurtles on into the chest of the man behind. And at last, Thorn's hands are empty. Her bandolier slack, 2 dozen of the Pilarthi in possession of her steel, some lying sprawled, trampled by their kin as they choke on blood, others still standing, hunched about their wound, the fight gone from them, replaced by hurt, the sorrow of steel, tears of blood. She draws her sword. The blade is long, thin, describing a slight curve, its edge cruel enough to bite through steel. Though it whispers from the scabbard, somehow it is loud enough to cut a moment's silence. This is where the Red Sister's heart beats. On the edge. With her other hand, she pulls the knife from her belt. Pilarthi surround Thorn on 3 sides, bathing her in the light of their torches, stepping over their dead, their footprints crimson on the limestone. Many, and more. A human tide scores hurrying to flank her, glimpse between the pillars. The foremost of them are slow now, watching, eyes upon the brightness of her blade, on the cutting edge upon which the fire's light is divided. Thorn stands savagely still, but she walks the path. And with each step, she gathers to herself the raw and fundamental power that both divides and joins creation. She is still, but the energies that build within tremble across her, making the air shake and the light dance. The Pilarthi watch her, the tall and the short, the wiry and the strong, bearers of axe and sword, of spear and bow. Paint-faced women, lips snarled about their teeth, pant for violence, hair wild or in braids, some spattered with the blood of friends. Grim-eyed men, clutching their sharpened iron before them, grind their jaws, muscles twitching beneath chain and leathers, waiting for the moment. They expect her to run. They know she will run. And she does, but at them. There is a joy in destruction, and when Thorn raises her head to regard the ruin all about her, there is a white smile among the scarlet dripping of her sweat. The blood is not hers, not all of it. The speed of a Hunska, the stark efficiency of the Sisterhood's blade lore, and the channeled power of the path have combined in one young woman to make a slaughter such has never been seen upon the Rock of Faith. She stands panting, both blades crimson from point to hilt, weary enough to fall, but with close on 100 mercenaries dead about her. In places, they are heaped. Thorn straightens, snarling against the pain of broken ribs. She is cut, her cheek opened, a puncture wound high on her thigh. Her speed is diminished. The path has thrown her, and lies now beyond reach, but her foe have known terror, and will not approach. The remainder watch her from back amongst the pillars, jackals stalking a wounded lion, too timid for attack, too hungry to run. The spear takes her between the shoulders. She should have heard it being thrown, sensed its approach, known it was coming,